I applaud the company's efforts to try and work with their customers over there, and certainly applaud our Representative Butler for his leadership in bringing this issue before you. And we support that, and I have, if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer those. And I'd also like to note that Commissioner Hemingway's here in case you have any really hard questions. I'll take the easy ones.
Well, thank you, Commissioner Beyer. I want to commend the Commission for your flexibility and under these difficult circumstances that
thank
we have
you,
already for acting so quickly. Questions, Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Lee, is there any other circumstance other than the Idaho Power that could come in under the language of the amendment and request them?
Madam Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, I don't think so. As Mr. Gale explained, Idaho Power is in a unique situation in that they represent a very small part of Oregon, and I should say they do it very well, but their rate base is there such that it's unusual. That's not the case with the other utilities. I wish we didn't have problems with the other ones to recover. We do, but it's not the same situation.
And follow-up, Madam Chair?
Follow-up.
Thank you. Would you see this as setting a precedent for any future situations in the rest of the state?
Madam Chair, Representative, I wouldn't. I hope you wouldn't.
Other questions? Well, thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you.
That completes those testifying on this bill. I'm going to close the public hearing on 2333 and open a work session on House Bill 2333. Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would move the dash one amendments to House Bill 2333.
Representative Rosenbaum moves the dash one amendment into House Bill 2333. Is there discussion? Is there objection? Seeing none, so ordered.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2333 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Rosenbaum moves House Bill 2333 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Dyer, aye. Representative Murphy?
Excused.
Representative Shoffler?
Aye.
Representative Kitts?
Aye.
Representative Rosenbaum?
Aye.
Chair Close.
Votes aye. Motion carries. And House Bill 2333 moves to the floor. Representative Butler has asked to carry the bill, so we will do that. And thank you very much. We will open a public hearing on House Bill 2846 and have the staff read the summary.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2846 requires the public contracting agency to determine the economic impact of awarding a contract to procure motor vehicle plates to non-resident bidder. Requires the agency add cost of economic impact to the bid of a non-resident bidder when determining the lowest responsible bidder.
We'll call forward Grover Simmons. Good morning.
Good morning, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Grover Simmons. I represent the Independent Employer Association and the Irwin-Hodson Company, which is a member of the association. Representative Smith wants to testify on this bill and indicated that she would be back in 3 minutes. So I'm a little out of sequence, but it's nevertheless a pleasure to be here and open this discussion. Madam Chair and members of the committee, earlier this session I testified before this committee on the subject of manufacturing state license plates and put into the record the financial details of the purchasing division's decision to send this public contract work to Nova Scotia, Canada. Briefly, you will recall that the Canadian low bid was $2,660,000. The Portland bidder, Irwin-Hodson Company, was 6.5% higher. We subsequently learned that that bid was 2 cents per plate higher than the Canadian bid. The Portland company's accountant was asked to compute the fiscal impact of losing the job to Canada. He did the numbers and concluded that there would be a payroll reduction or loss to the community of $300,000 in salary per year, and a net loss of taxes and employee benefits, including health insurance, of $273,340. This is based on the company having to lay off 15 employees and the estimate that 7 of those employees would have limited funds and probably qualify for the Oregon Health Plan. In an effort to keep this work in Oregon, House Bill 2846 says that the cost impact on state and local governments and on the economy of the state shall be added to the bid of a non-resident bidder, and then the contract shall be awarded to the lowest responsible bidder. The cost impact analysis will consider the value of lost salaries and wages, the loss of employment in the state, the loss of state and local taxes, including workers' compensation premiums and unemployment insurance and TriMet taxes, the loss of health insurance and other verifiable employee benefits which accrue to Oregon employees. Under this bill, the idea of using cost impact in determining the lowest responsible bidder would only apply to the purchasing of license plates. It would not be applied across the board to all public contracting. The construction industry does not want this new concept applied to their business, so House Bill 2846 accommodates their wishes. Madam Chair, as you know, there is widespread interest in keeping this license at work in Oregon. There have been any number of radio talk shows, editorials, television press conferences in support of doing something about what happened. Even the Oregonian newspaper editorial board said, quote, sending a contract out of state to Canada, no less, doesn't make a lot of sense, especially from a state with a 6.8% unemployment rate, close quote. Now, we all know that unemployment rate has gone up 7% since that editorial comment was made. House Bill 2846 is our best effort in trying to address these concerns, in protecting the interests of the state and local government, the interests of taxpayers, as well as the interests of the manufacturing company, which has been doing business and paying taxes in Portland for 108 years. I urge each of you to support the bill, and I thank you for your consideration.
Thank you very much, Grover. Questions from the committee? Representative Kitts.
Grover, I do support this bill, so let me just go on record as saying that before I ask these questions, because I don't want them to seem like I don't support the bill. The bid, as it was given, and as a result of this bid going to Canada, they had to lay off 15 people. Is that potential to lay off, or is that an actual laying off?
Madam Chair and Representative Kitts, that is a potential layoff that may have already started, but the final figure would be approximately 15 people. And the reason is, it's my understanding that the transfer occurs in June. That's when the Canadian work really begins. There are, I see people in the audience who can testify exactly to when that transfer is made, but it's my understanding that it's a June cutoff period for the Portland company.
Follow up.
Second of all, I would like to thank, for the record, Representative Smith for her passionate pleas on behalf of this issue. It doesn't go unnoticed, and I wish that at least half the legislature had her passion for keeping Oregon jobs in Oregon. We wouldn't be in the state that we're in now. Thank you.
Welcome, Representative Smith. Are there other questions?
I was told to return at 9 o'clock, and you already beat me to the punch.
I apologize, Representative Smith. We are moving quickly this morning.
Well, good for you.
All the green that's in the building.
Absolutely.
Green light.
I hope I don't repeat what Grover Simmons has stated. Have you received my testimony? Kind of important that you do.
The process of getting it.
I don't want to be redundant, so I am just going to say that I had worked on this during the interim. When I received my Oregonian newspaper, as so many of us do, and the front page headline is that Oregon sends jobs to Canada, I'm going, what? We have the highest unemployment rate in the state. So through some investigation and consultation, during the interim in December, we had a hearing in the General Government Committee to bring light of the situation. Why has this happened? According to Oregon law, the purchasing department of administrative services is bound to give a low bidder. However, I think there's some archaic language on the law that dates back to the 1930s. In House Bill 2847, we look at the impact of a non-resident bidder in that. As you know, Oregon has 10% reciprocity in its agreements with other states, and in that law, the term state is used. And the purchasing department at DAS was very clear that that means the United States, a state of the union. However, in international law, I think as we often can see, the word state is used for countries or provinces. So this bill would allow the terms province or country in it to make sure that the 10% reciprocity is used. House Bill 2846 requires the economic impact in terming in giving awards to out-of-state. What will that do to our economic impact in the state? Well, in losing 15 jobs, we obviously lose a tremendous tax base, income taxes, TriMet taxes, since this company is located in Portland. Local taxes, state taxes. Then also the insurance benefits that these people have. And if these insurance, and if these people choose to go into the Oregon Health Plan because of their income, they make $20,000 a year, they would qualify for the Oregon Health Plan and quite possibly food stamps. Although I have not calculated the rate on the state what food stamps and or health plan services would cost, but I submit we have not saved $184,000. As in my testimony, you can see that we will probably lose about $388,000 by the time you add up all those things. This is so the state of Oregon can save 2 cents on the license plate. Then I ask myself, why is it cheaper for a Canadian company to do this? Is it quite possibly because through our infinite wisdom or foolishness, we have regulated our businesses and companies in Oregon to the point that they are not competitive? Maybe we have more restrictions on us than Canada does. Also, I want you to consider the exchange rate of the dollar, the 30% hit. Was that calculated in making this? I think that should have been used. As you know, I can take a dollar to Canada and buy $1.30 worth of goods in Canada for that. So I would tend to look very seriously at this and give it consideration. Now, this bill is very narrow in focus. It deals with license plates only. However, I think we need to send a message to our government agencies doing business in this state that Oregon jobs count. We need Oregon jobs. This may be only 15 to 30 jobs, but I happen to think those jobs are very important. I think it's a mindset that we need to develop in this state to make sure we keep those jobs. Any questions?
Madam Chair, I have one.
Representative Shopler.
I agree with what you're saying, Representative Smith, and I want to vote on this. But I think also Canadian companies have an advantage in that I think they have universal health care in Canada. That's a big advantage. Thank you.
It is. Representative Smith, I was wondering, you said that you exempt in that the construction industry wanted to be exempted from this. And can you tell me why that was?
I don't know that.
I testified to that. Yeah.
Could you answer that?
I believe, Madam Chair, Grover Simmons again. I've heard Jessica Harris testify a couple of times on this general subject, and it seemed to me that she believed that it would complicate their industry in the bidding process, particularly as they bid on work in nearby states, as in Washington. I don't quite understand the full rationale of that, but she was pretty clear and adamant that she didn't want our concept to rain on her parade. and so we have accommodated that position. May I put another point in the record, Madam Chair? Representative Smith alluded to the use of the word state in the current law. The reason that is significant is that under the current statute, the preference statute, the word state is used, and the Deputy Attorney General restricted the interpretation of the word state to apply only to those states within the United States. At the time, I thought that was overly narrow, if you will. And so I'd like just to put into the record the definition of state. Let me give this to the staff person, please. I think it might be helpful to broaden our thinking on what that word can and ought to mean when applied to the purchasing law in Oregon. Under the definition of state, we get down here to number 8, the sovereign power of political entity. 9, a particular form of government. 10, a body politic, especially one constituting a nation. 11, one of more or less internally autonomous units of a federal government. Now, you get right down to the nub of this problem. If Oregon had really wanted to keep this work in state in Oregon and preserve those jobs, they could have gone to the current dictionary, used the definition of the word state, and applied the preference statute, and maybe that would have done the job. But nevertheless, I think it's helpful to have that in the record just for technical purposes.
Thank you. Representative Smith, did you want to comment?
Yeah, I am not aware of Washington State contractors. I might be a little hard-nosed in this, but I'm concerned about Oregon jobs, not Washington State contractors. Washington State can deal with their own unemployment problems. I want to make the point on this. This company has been in business since 1917, and there's a reason for that. They employ a type of technology where only two companies in entire North America use. One is Waldown, Canada. The other is here. This same company makes license plates for many other states who don't use the prison system. And it was brought up, you know, why doesn't Oregon license plate? Well, Oregon has never made their license plates in prison. This company has always done it. This company has gone the umpteenth mile to invest in technology to make the license plates. They are willing to hire locally. It's a generational company, and I think that's exactly the type of company we need to support in this state. And by the way, they lose 25% of their workforce by losing this contract.
And a whole lot of revenue to the state. In taxes. Representative Merkley.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Smith, Mr. Grover. I just want to make sure I understand that this bill as written just affects the production of license plates. Or are there other instances that subsection 3, where we're expanding it to other nations, do we know of any other cases that this bill might possibly affect?
It's all restricted to license plates. So unless I don't know why that would be a problem, unless they're referring to House Bill 2848.
Well, let me just assume that's right. Let me follow up for a minute.
Follow up.
Is there?
Yeah.
Has there been any conversations with Canadian Consul General or any other entity as to how this might reverberate in terms of other Oregon businesses that have contracts with Canada possibly getting retaliatory?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Murphy. This has only to do with license plate, and this is the first time Canada has ever received this contract, so I don't think bringing business back to Oregon is going to cause any reverberations at all. I have not had conversations with that company, but I better be quiet.
Thank you.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to thank you, Representative Smith, for bringing this bill before us. Irwin Hudson is an employer in my district, and these are not just good family wage jobs, but they're good union jobs, and so we really don't want to lose them. I noticed there's no emergency clause in the bill. Is that because it is too late to reverse the decision that's been made for this coming cycle?
Madam Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, yes. By the way, I was going to mention the union situation because I wasn't quite sure why the Washington State contractors, who I believe are non-union, would object to this since it's not a union shop anyway. So the reason why there is an emergency clause is because I believe the contract expires in September, and it needs to be renewed every 3 years after that. So when the contract expires in September and it's renewed, I'm hoping that they will look at the Oregon situation in light of the possibility of these new laws that we could pass.
And I'll follow up with you, Madam Chair. And just an additional comment that I fully support this, but I think it needs to be pointed out that one way these kinds of policies are also being challenged, and we can't do much about it at a state level, is with free trade agreements at a federal level, which have been used to undermine states and our nation's ability to keep good jobs here within our borders. So I think that's another danger that we have to be aware of.
Representative Rosenbaum, you're entirely right. And when Representative Murphy raised that point of view, I didn't want to get on my soapbox and start preaching, because that has certainly happened within the agricultural industry in our state. This is just, one little bill, maybe it's not so little, but maybe it will say something important and try to save a few jobs. I agree with the trade aspect entirely, and has put Oregon industry and natural resources sometimes at a disadvantage, and it makes it very hard to do business in this state, and that's a shame.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We'll call Diane Lancaster of NASS, Kelly Taylor, DMV, and Bill Nesby, DOJ. It's Nestle, isn't it? Nestle. I'm sorry, Bill, that's Nestle, correct?
Madam Chair, that's right.
Madam Chair, I apologize for my poor penmanship. Good morning. I'm Diane Lancaster, the Chief Procurement Officer for the Department of Administrative Services, and as you know, I have with me Kelly Taylor from the Division of Motor Vehicles at ODOT and Mr. William Nestle from the Department of Justice. We're here to provide information to the committee, and being passed out right now is the written testimony from my department, as well as, for your, again, refreshment, a packet of information that we prepared this winter when these two contracts arose and when the award issues came up. And so that information is there for your reference again, and it contains a variety of exhibits in it. That's why it's so hefty. There, in our office, I would also like to say it caused us great anguish to have to go through that award process. We're all Oregonians, and we mightily care about the issues that are presented to the committee, and I just wanted to let you know that. We have analyzed House Bill 2846. We've tried to do a thorough job to be of service to you today, and we see three major changes that this bill creates. One is to expand the reciprocal bidding preference statutes that currently exist. It's been alluded to before in Mr. Simmons' testimony, to include provinces and nations in the assessment of preferences that other entities place on Oregon bidders if they were to come to their entity to bid. This Section 3 of this statute, 279029, would require that DAS publish annually reliable information that all local governments and state agencies can use to determine whether, when they receive a bid from an out-of-country bidder, what sort of preference that country or that province applies to that would disadvantage Oregon bidders in that country or province. In addition, Mr. Simmons has already talked about the economic study and the value-added study that would be used to apply a preference in the case of motor vehicle plate purchases in this state. And then finally, the term, the definition of resident bidder has also been modified to include an Oregon bidder who would propose to manufacture license plates in this state. So there is a change in that definitional section as well. I think if you go to page 3 of the written testimony, we get into the discussion of the issues around administering the bill as it is currently written. We've tried to assess how to do that as it's currently written, and we've also tried to make any suggestions or possible thoughts that you might want to consider in evaluating the bid in its current form. I think the expansion of the reciprocal preference law is the first item on page 3, and we run right into some international trade agreement considerations. The U.S., as you know, is a signatory to there are a number of agreements, trade agreements generally, we call them, including the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trades, which is now known as the WTO, the World Trade Organization. These agreements generally prohibit each nation that's a signatory and the political subdivisions of those nations from adopting laws that would provide preference to citizens of the nation or its political subdivisions as compared with the citizens of other nations. And in addition to that, there is, in the WTO, there is a sub-federal government agreement, which I think comes specifically into this case at hand. And that is an agreement that applies the same non-discrimination provisions at the state or provincial level. Now, what that means is that there's an overarching national country-by-country group of signatories, generally, and then there's a sub-federal or sub-state agreement that discusses and invites participants to agree to non-discriminatory status. Oregon signed on to that sub-federal agreement under Governor Barbara Roberts' administration some years ago. We note that in our advice received from Department of Justice on the subject that Canada did not sign on to the sub-federal agreement. So that's one country, and this is in about paragraph 3 of the discussion, where that means that the Canadian provinces could, if they wanted to, apply a preference to an in-province bidder against an out-of-country or out-of-province bidder. It doesn't mean that they have done that, and in the case of Nova Scotia, we went to some lengths to determine that they don't have an in-province preference. But it does open the door for the committee to consider what Mr. Cutler is saying, that there is a potential possibility for Oregon to apply a preference specifically to Canadian provinces. So we bring that just for your thought. He had been evaluating Senate Bill 546, which was presented in public hearing last week. And he recommended for that purpose that Senate Bill 546, as it was currently written, should be amended to include language that would limit its applicability to circumstances where the preference isn't prohibited. And he's given some thoughts on that. So that's an area that might bear further study and further drafting. Because you do run into some federal issues. There were some other issues that the reciprocal preference law change brought to mind, and one of them was the task of actually determining what are the preferences that other countries and their provinces, or we would assume the subgroups of those countries, would levy or would use against a bidder from Oregon. This isn't something we do currently. We do assess all 50 states of the union, and we publish that annually. And in fact,
Ms. Lancaster, I think you're needing to cut to the chase here.
Okay.
You're kind of wandering a little bit.
All right. I'm sorry, ma'am. We went on through to talk about economic impact determination and the issues that we would face in wrestling with that. We've offered some alternatives there. We consulted with the Employment Department about how such a study could be done expediently, and you can read for yourselves what that would include. It would require perhaps, some thought about the complexity of the study that is currently required as the language is currently laid out. And then finally, there is the addition of new resident criteria. We could use some clarity there, but that's laid out at page 3. And we're all available for further questions, and I believe Kelly Taylor has some additional facts that she'd like to give you.
I would just like to ask you, you know, it seems unfortunate that this has to come before us in bill form. It seems to me that this is something that DASH should have done on their own. We shouldn't have to be dealing with this issue. And I would hope in the future that DAS will
avoid this kind of confrontation with the legislature and be more open. You have several protests that you've given us that were filed on this thing. It doesn't appear to me that you paid any attention to these protests, and I think that is unfortunate.
Yes, ma'am.
Kelly?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Kelly Taylor, Department of Transportation. I just wanted to speak to the history of the contracts. This is the first time in all the years there's ever been a competitive bid. There's always been put out the bid, but there's never been any competition. It's always been pretty much just the one company in Portland bidding. And this is the first time that the prices on the place have ever come down. So I know that the bid process is meant to be to stir competition. It did. Compared to the previous contract that we had with Aaron Hodson, the current contract is over $500,000 less each year. So it was a significant saving over the price that we've been paying for plates. I just wanted to put that on record. Whatever policy you guys decide is what we'll do. I just want you to know that the competitive bid process appeared to work as far as bringing the price down. If you want us to pay more for plates, have them done in Oregon, we can do that.
Kelly, will you comment on what Representative Smith said about the additional costs in unemployment compensation, health benefits, social services? Do you think it's important that we consider those things?
Madam Chair, yes, I do. And I called and talked to the president of the company because I was concerned when I had heard that it would cost 15 to 30 jobs, and knowing that the 30 jobs is their total plate processing, I actually called them because I was concerned about that, and I asked them, you know, how much does Oregon represent of the plate business that you do? And he said 25%. So I'm not sure, you know, and I asked him how many jobs it was at this point, and he said probably around 3. So I don't know whether it really will equal 50% of their workload when we're 25% of the business. I'm not sure. And I don't know, after you add all that up, how it compares against the $500,000 a year extra it would cost taxpayers to buy plates. I don't know which will be more.
Go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I was just here to answer any technical questions you might have. One thing I would like to say is that there were 2 license plate protests. These people came to the Department of Justice asking what's the right thing to do under the law. They were merely seeking legal advice, and I think that this is a very mainstream advice in which these protests were denied. You'll notice that is about a dozen-page document in which the state went over everything that had to be said in terms of a protest in good faith, and I think that this thing is the kind of thing that would have been upheld by any court in Oregon. So, the fact of the matter is when the Department of Administrative Services and DMV looked at this statute, they didn't have the tools in terms of statutory authority to do anything other than to award these contracts to the lowest responsible bidder, which is determined by the bottom line. Mr. Simmons already told you who the lowest bidder was and what the difference was, and it was the Canadian firm, unfortunately. But it was a lawful and very thoroughly considered procurement process. I'd just like to say that.
Well, Bill, let me ask you in particular about the letter from George Gregoris. Apparently he's an attorney for Irwin Hodson. He has a very extensive letter, Exhibit 5. He goes through different sections of the ITB, seems to make a very good case. Do you want to comment on that?
Yeah, there are 2 points. Number one, with respect to Oregon's reciprocal preference, they maintain that there was a discriminatory preference imposed either by Nova Scotia or Canada. We worked for hours and we could not find such a thing, so there was no reciprocal preference for us to apply in this case in favor of Irwin Hodson. It just plain wasn't there. The second aspect of the protest had to do with the in-state bidding preference, or excuse me, the in-state printing preference. And we determined that the metallurgy involved, the tool and die stamping of metal plates, that form of fabrication is not state printing. And I think that that also was correct in terms of the history of the statutes that involved state printing and the preference for that.
Could you comment on this statement? The agreement on international trade referenced in DAS discussions with Alberta officials applies as between Canadian provinces only. A copy of the agreement on international trade, Chapter 5 procurement, is enclosed herewith.
There were no impacts at all of any international trade treaties on this protest.
Apparently they disagreed with you on that?
I don't think that they ever raised that. They made that statement, but that's absolutely irrelevant. This particular procurement was not subject to any trade treaty.
Okay. Questions? Representative Gallegos.
Yeah. Diane. Page 4 of your testimony, the bottom paragraph, you mentioned that the bill will be difficult and costly to implement. Clearly, the bill only focuses on license plates. I'd like to understand how costly you think it would be to implement this bidding process for plates.
Yes, Representative Close, Representative Gallegos. The issue came up around the study. Primarily, we talked with the employment department. We talked with a gentleman there who is an economist who shared with us that the list of factors as it now stands doesn't fit any model, that the computer model that they have available, and particularly the tax loss of tax revenue. They do have a model at employment department which has certain investment income and benefit values that they can calculate, and so if this bill didn't call for quite so many impacts, or if it could, the impacts could be tailored to what the employment department could generate easily and quickly, then the expensive proposition, frankly, of getting an outside consultant, a trained economist, to do this could be avoided. That was a substantial cost, and they validated that a trained economist to do this kind of work for a very unique manufacturing process, since there are only two, this isn't a big industry, would cost a good $50,000, and that's what we put in our fiscal impact. So employment department does have some model available, and there are some features that could be used in terms of evaluating the income and benefit.
Go ahead.
Can you provide a written breakdown of why or what that $50,000 entails?
Ma'am, we did not do a request for information given the time needed to prepare. We looked at all of the personal service contracts that have come through our office for similar kinds of study. We discussed a couple of those with Mr. Ayer at the Employment Department, and he validated they ran anywhere from $50,000 to $120,000. He validated that for the work to be performed, given the list of factors, that he would think that the $50,000 figure would certainly be in the ballpark in his professional estimation, and he is the Employment Department economist.
All right.
Madam Chair, please.
Representative Rosenbaum and then Representative Schaffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Diane and Bill, just asking you to be proactive about this bill. I'm wondering, no one wants to incur, obviously, huge expenses for studies if there's a simpler way to solve the problem. Could we just amend the definition of printing so that it would include the process by which license plates are made and resolve it that way?
Madam Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, I'll let Mr. Nestle speak for himself since he's done an extensive study of that statute. I don't know. The printing bill is not under consideration under this particular format. The printing bill is an interesting preference because it sets up the notion that all printing will be done in state and then establishes some exceptions. So I don't have specific language to suggest, but certainly Bill might have a thought or two.
Madam Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, Bill Nestle. Actually, I understand that there's House Bill 2848 that actually parrots the in-state printing preference and says that with respect to the production of license plates purchased for the state of Oregon, that same preference will apply. And it could be also get the same impact with licenses if this body would, instead of taking that, amend ORS 282.210 to provide the general rule that all license plates purchased by the state of Oregon shall be manufactured in the state of Oregon unless the in-state bids are not reasonably competitive the work cannot be performed in the state, or the lowest price for which the work can be procured within the state exceeds prices usually and customarily charged by Oregon business. And that would do it.
Mm-hmm. Representative Schlossman.
Thank you. I'm not sure, but I don't think Mr. Simmons and Representative Smith spent $50,000 to come up with their figures. Assuming that the number 15 employees being laid off is going to be correct, and I assume that is correct. Now, I don't know why it cost $50,000, and I don't want to know. But I know they didn't spend $50,000 to come to these amounts. And one more thing, I don't know if you all were here the day that Mr. Simmons provided us with a brief show of how this plate making process went on, but there was some printing involved there, and forgive me if I'm wrong, but they aren't stamped out, they're laminated onto an already stamped out plate. Is that, am I correct in that?
Madam Chair and Representative Schaffler, there are two kinds of plates, and I was not here, so I did not see which plate he was demonstrating. The tree plate that you all know, the main Oregon license plate, is what's known as an embossed plate. And in that process, the pre-printed laminate is purchased from a company, 3M, out of state, and transferred in. And the laminate is affixed to plain aluminum sheeting, big roll. So big sheeting of laminate going onto big sheeting of aluminum. It then is cut into the shape of a license plate, and the little holes are made for your bolts on your car. Mm-hmm. And then it goes in a big stack, so then they just look like flat tree-looking plates on aluminum. But then the letters and numbers are actually, by human being, put into a tray, and a big machine chunked down onto it and actually embosses it. And then it goes through a paint roller that just paints the raised letters. That's how your numbers get. So that is more of a manufacturing process. Now, the flat plate, which is the Crater Lake plate, the only one we're doing what's known as the flat plate technology, is more of a printing process in that the laminate and sheeting and everything is being painted in the machine as it's going through, and that is a flat plate. So the embossed plates, which is the majority of our plates, the salmon plate, the cultural trust plate, the tree plate, the old blue and yellow plates, all the other plates that we do for other kinds of vehicles, those are all embossed plates. Mm-hmm. It's only the Crater Lake plate that is the printing type process that is a truly at that moment being painted and printed and everything all at the same time.
Thank you. One more follow-up.
Follow-up. And then Representative Kitts.
No, this isn't any reflection on you guys, but I just have to make this comment. $50,000 to come to these figures that could have been done in 20 minutes, maybe for a layman like me with a calculator. I'm telling you, we are being consulted and studied and work-grouped and lawyered and accounted and being counted into bankruptcy because of all this stuff going on. If a layman with a thimble full of common sense could do it in a few minutes with a calculator, and I'm talking about me, if I may brag, a thimble full of common sense. But I just, that $50,000, just, I find that totally, I'm sorry, unacceptable. I just cannot believe it. If we're spending that kind of money to come up with the figures that Representative Smith and Mr. Simmons came up with, probably in half an hour, we're wasting our money, folks. And I'm sorry. You people are nice people. I don't want to beat up on you, but I just think that's outlandish. Maybe I'm ignorant of something, and I'd be more than happy for after this if you filled me in on how we came to that amount. Thank you very much, and keep up the good work. And happy St. Pat's Day,
Representative Kitts.
How do you follow that? First of all, I want to echo what you said, so please don't take that as a negative. I would agree with you, and I think you took half my testimony. That being said, I think that this bill really boils down to Oregon jobs first and foremost, and I've got to tell you that to come before a committee and say that it's going to cost $50,000, as Mr. Schaffler has so eloquently pointed out, is a tough sell. I think anyone on this committee would do it for you for half. That being said, I would emphatically urge my colleagues on this committee to support this bill. regardless of what appears to be a $50,000 price tag, which I think that all of us would agree is absolutely crazy, which would maybe invoke the curiosity of this committee and other committees to look at just how DAS is spending their money. So I would like to say I support this bill. Thank you, Mr. Schaffler, for taking half my testimony.
Okay, one more, and then we're going to move on. Representative Merkley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. While we're on this cost basis, my comment, half question is, I gather you're saying it's so expensive because you have to survey essentially the entire universe of nations or other political entities that may have preferences, and that there's no existing database from which to find that, if I read your testimony correctly. And it seems to me that leads to a series of possible ways to amend this bill so it's much less expensive. One comment has been amending the definition of printing, but maybe the universe doesn't need to be so broad in this as to survey all the entire world. Maybe it could be restricted to countries or provinces that have previously bid on contracts in Oregon or something of that nature. Have you considered that type of idea or other ideas that would greatly reduce your expense?
Representative Close, Representative Merkley, I think that's what we were trying to do, and to suggest some other possibilities. If the printing statute were to be amended, as is suggested by the other bill in this trilogy, that would remove us from this whole area of reciprocal preference. We're talking about two different laws, and the one that is proposed to be changed in this bill, in 2846, is a difficult one. Because of its global impact, frankly. So there is the issue of creating a new database, and then an economic study. No one in the state government actually does one to this level, and it would have to be defensible in court. It would have to be objective and that sort of thing. We don't know exactly how much it would cost. That was a best guess estimate. But definitely setting up this kind of program is new, and it does create some fiscal impact. So the point about the printing statute is well taken.
Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2846. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2846. Representative Kitts.
Madam Chair, I would move that we move 2846 to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Kitts has moved House Bill 2846 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Representative Merkley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Since this work is in Representative Rosenbaum's district, I'd particularly like to get her thoughts here. But what I'm hearing is that there may be a much simpler way to approach this problem. And I don't know if any members of this committee have had more detailed conversations. And I'd just like to hear of anyone's thought as to why we should go this direction rather than some other direction that has apparently existed in another bill, or if not exists in another bill, has been proposed by some of the folks who would be involved in implementing this bill. So if there's any background anyone can fill in to help with that, I'd appreciate it.
Madam Chair. Representative Gallegos.
Yeah, if I just bring you back to Representative Smith's testimony, she has introduced three bills, this one as well as the other bills, 2847, is talking about the economic impact of a non-resident bidder, and then 2848 as well, to require license plates to be manufactured by Oregon private contractors. And I think 2848 is the one that amends the printing process. I think, as she mentioned, I believe the intent of the three instead of just one is to make sure that we are able to actually resolve these problems and not see them back here in the House. Again, I'm losing jobs.
Representative Kitts?
I would also ask that as we follow this over to the Senate, that possibly we look at an amendment for the definition to save the money, further save the money within the bureaucracy here in the Senate, if applicable.
Okay, I would just comment that there's no reason we can't consider the other bills, but at this point we are considering this bill. So that is that's what the motion is. Further discussion?
I was just going to ask Megan if she knows, have the other two bills been referred to this committee as well?
Yes, I have.
And Madam Chair, I'll just comment. I'll support this today, but I do think that we want to go for the most bang for the buck. So if there is a simpler way to do this that's contained in one of the other bills. Certainly that's, that should be our first choice. Okay. Second.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to support this bill today really as a symbolic statement about the challenges we have in our economy and the importance of these type of jobs. I would like to express, though, the hope that we'll find the most cost-effective way to the solution. And if it turns out that 2848 or some version of it solves this in a much cleaner fashion than setting up a possible international issue over trade preferences, I'd certainly like to see us go that way, and perhaps we can reconsider whether to keep this bill on the floor if we find a better solution.
Thank you. Clerk will call the roll.
Representative Jason?
Aye.
Representative Merkley?
Aye.
Representative Schaffer?
Aye.
Representative
Kitts? Aye.
Representative Rosenbaum?
Aye.
Chair Close.
Well, it's aye. House Bill 2846 moves to the House floor, and Representative Tootie Smith will carry the bill. Thank you. Closing the work session on House Bill 2846. Okay, I'm opening a work session on House Bill 2230, and I'm going to call. Here's our sign sheet. I think we'll call our Public Utility Commissioner first and have the staff read the summary.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, House Bill 2230, last heard on January 27th, allows the Public Utility Commission to assume the primary responsibility for resolving consumer complaints relating to unauthorized changes in telecommunications carriers in violation of federal laws, otherwise known as LAMI. We have a dash three amendments, which prohibits the PUC from adopting rules that relate to the radio common carriers, impose more stringent rules on penalties for slamming than what federal laws allow, and specifies that the PUC assumes responsibility for slamming that the remedies they adopt are exclusive and no other civil action or state administrative proceedings may be brought against the telecommunications carrier. Thank you.
Commissioner Barr, I wanted to give you first chance to see if you had a time constraint.
I don't have a time constraint, Madam Chair. Since these are the industry's amendments, I suggest it might be
good. Thank you. We'll call Paul Romaine. And Brent Wolf, is Brent coming forward as well? Committee, we have just the dash three today. The dash one and two were not quite exactly what was agreed on, so that's why we have the dash three and not the one and two. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Paul Romaine. I'm an attorney in Portland, and I'm here representing MCI WorldCom.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, good morning. Grant Wolf, representing the Oregon Telecommunications Association.
We are here in support of the Dash 3 amendments to 2230, and let me make a couple of statements. First, in response to an article that was in the paper today and some radio reports coming down, this bill expands Oregon's ability to deal with slamming, which we all abhor. It does not contract, it does not take the state out of the regulating slamming. It gives more authority to the state to regulate and to go after those who slam. Somehow, and I don't know how it got into the paper, but there was a story today basically that said that this was in effect taking the state out of the business. You heard testimony on this bill and other bills earlier that basically said that the Justice Department had no authority to go after individual complaints. What they did is they took a big picture kind of look at the problem. You heard the PUC saying they had no authority to go after individual complaints to resolve it. When you were slammed, where did you call? Who'd you go to? You know, we didn't have our Ghostbusters. We are now creating our Ghostbusters. We have one agency, the Utility Commission, which is assigned the duty of regulating the telecommunications industry that a consumer can go to. That's what this bill is all about. The controversy over this bill is whether it would allow for additional finding authority, specifically with the PUC, or whether it would require the PUC to do as they now have to do, which is in effect go to court. It does not, the difference between the two bills that were submitted on this, one gives them the finding authority, one does not. It makes them go through their current finding authority. What the amendments to this bill does is, number one, make sure that the PUC can in effect impose, adopt the federal regs as standards. They're not necessarily adopting those regs because you can't delegate authority that way, but what they're doing is they will be able to adopt rules and regs that are in effect consistent with the federal laws and regulations and federal FCC orders on this particular subject. It gives them the authority to enforce what the feds now can enforce. That's a step forward because they don't have that authority now. Number two, it says that this doesn't apply to radio common carriers, cell phones. To slam somebody with a cell phone, you have to get physical. You have to bring them into the shop, take away their phone, give them a new phone, and give them a new phone number. It's not the same thing as slamming somebody with a landline. So we don't, in effect, use this for cellular. And the final thing that it does is basically say that you get one agency that you have to deal with on this. If you complain to the PUC, the PUC handles it. That's the place that you want people to go to. And it means that that complaint can't be used again to hit you by some other agency. That's, in effect, paragraph 5 of the amendments. So that's all we're asking for. It is a tremendous step forward for the state. It may not be as far forward as some people would like to go, but we believe it's a good step forward to actually get the complaints resolved on a timely basis. I don't know if Brant has anything more to add, but
for the record, again, Brant Wolf representing the OTA. No, I just wanted to indicate that in past testimony here before the committee, the OTA opposed House Bill 2230, and with the adoption of the Dash 3 amendments, our position would change from one of opposition to one of support. That's the extent of my testimony.
Gentlemen, could you tell us how many people worked on this? I know you had a group that was trying to come to agreement.
Well, basically what we did, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I met with some of the folks involved in the industry, and then we had meetings with the PUC. And the PUC has no problems with the bill. I believe, to be fair to the PUC, obviously any state agency, they would like more power if they could get it, more authority for anything. But they're fine with the thing as it exists right now. I think that was actually their statement in the paper today.
Questions?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Branson, Paul, I have no problem with the language that says we'll adopt the federal standard. I think that was the testimony from everybody on the original bills is what they wanted to see happen. But as far as this exclusive remedy language, it seems to me in our first hearing that we did have testimony from the Department of Justice that they currently pursued some of these complaints through the consumer protection arm of DOJ. And I apologize for reading the newspaper, but it sounds to me from everything I've heard that the industry does not support giving civil penalty authority to the PUC. So I guess my question would be, why would we be taking away the ability of government to go after remedies for individual consumers if we're not giving it to anybody else in any other form?
Madam Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, you're not taking away anything. What you're doing is adding. The reason the Justice Department was involved, their testimony, is basically the PUC was not. The PUC couldn't do anything about this. Okay? So this bill gives the PUC authority to handle those individual complaints. Justice Department testified they couldn't handle individual complaints. They couldn't get you the particular rebate. That was not their job. They looked at sort of a pattern more than anything else. What we're saying in this bill, we're not taking away their authority. What we're saying is if you get over to the PUC. The PUC works on your complaint. They resolve your complaint. You can't then get hit by another state agency on the, for the exact same thing, or be have that complaint used as part of a sort of big picture kind of complaint. You get one shot. You don't get slapped once on one side of the face by one state agency and then the other side by the other state agency. You go to the PUC, you get it resolved, they get your service back to normal, they get all charges waived, anything like that. If they happen to decide to use their current authority to go to court, then they can go to court. We're not giving them additional civil penalty authority. But we're not taking away anything from the Department of Justice unless you think the ability to hit you twice is taking something away from them. Because right now, there is no twice. There's just once. It just happens to be Department of Justice.
So, follow-up. Well, Chair, so what would be the ability of government to go after a bad apple, not, I'm sure, anybody that you represent, but some company that is doing this consistently as a way of generating revenue? What remedy would we have left if this bill passes to do something to penalize them beyond just making them undo the bad thing that they already did?
Madam Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, I believe, and we can call it PUC backup to indicate exactly how they can impose fines, but I believe they can do that already.
And we will have Commissioner Beyer up to comment on that. Can you tell me, Paul, what is done in other states? I think the newspaper article this morning talked about how we're only one of 8 states that doesn't have this authority. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, I believe that the federal state enforcement of federal rules is the vast majority, or majority of the states have now adopted, in effect, the federal rules as their standards. Some go further and have the fining authority, to be fair, and some do not, like ours. But basically, what you're doing is adopting, the feds have stepped in, they've sort of set the bar, and most states are adopting that as the bar. So we're just joining everybody else. Right now, you have limited authority in this state to resolve the individual complaints.
Okay. Other questions? Thank you. Representative Gallegos.
Yeah, maybe my question already really is answered. The difference here in 2198 was the other bill that we heard of the last time and received testimony. And it looks like the big difference here really is in from 2198 was Section 3 imposing the civil penalty up to a certain dollar amount, and it looks like it, can you just kind of compare the two, what we already heard on and what kind of the differences, just a brief overview of how this the two differ?
Madam Chair, Representative Gallegos, that you hit on the difference. Basically, the difference between the two bills is the ability to for the PUC to impose a fine versus having to go to court to impose a fine.
Thank you.
And also to clarify, did not the PUC themselves bring forward those two bills, one with the authority and one without?
Madam Chair, yes. They gave you a choice, as you have in telecommunication services.
I think that was an advertisement. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
And we will call the Public Utility Commission forward, Clark Jackson and Lee Beyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Lee Beyer, Public Utility Commissioner of Oregon. And Clark Jackson's with me. Clark runs our consumer program. Mr. Romaine said, our staff has been working with them on these amendments, and I guess what fits is the old political cliche is that the art of legislation is the art of doing what's possible. I think this falls into the category of that. We proposed this originally, and the reason we brought this issue before you is in an attempt to try and help Oregon citizens that were having trouble with slamming. Slamming, as you know, as we said last time, is the switching of customer services without the customer's approval. In effect, it's stealing from the customer. What these amendments do is put the PUC in a position where a customer can call us and we can represent them and try and resolve their complaints to the best of our abilities. The best of our abilities is our ability to persuade. We do have authority in general to go to the courts to seek fines. But the reality of that situation is we do not go to the courts to seek fines because it is more expensive to seek the fines than the fines that would be imposed. Everybody knows that. So that's the reality of the situation. But frankly, that's just the political field that we play in. That's the way it is. I do believe that giving us the authority to implement or opt into the Federal Communications Commission program is in the best interest of consumers. We will do the best that we can for them. We have a good track record, but it doesn't leave us with much of a hammer. So I just want to be very clear on that. The other issue that came up was the exclusive remedy. We do not have any position on that one. You'll need to ask the Department of Justice about that. What they were dealing with here is essentially justice, as they said last time, cannot represent individual Oregonians. They represent a class in the Fair Trade Practices Act, and they have been active in that in the past, and you'll have to ask them what the effect of that is. I'm not an attorney. I guess the bottom line is that we're cooperative with companies. By and large, we have a very good relationship with them. This is giving Oregonians an additional level of protection that doesn't exist now. I frankly say it's not the best, but you know, you deal with what you have, and we'll do what we can if you choose to make this Oregon's policy, and if it doesn't work, we'll be back to see you in the next session.
So, Commissioner, there's nothing to prohibit us from putting a fine on in the future, a larger civil penalty?
The legislature, Madam Chair, can do whatever it sees as the correct policy for the state.
Questions? Did you want to comment?
Not at this time, unless you have questions, Madam Chair.
Clark, maybe you could just go through, since you represent the consumer programs, just how many complaints we're talking about and what has been the activity on this in your area.
Let me review a little bit for the record. Clark Jackson, Manager of Consumer Services for the Commission. I'll review a little bit of our testimony from January 28 because that's getting to be quite a while ago. We have about 34,000 inquiries that come into the Commission. About 9,000 of those were telephone related. Of that, we opened, I believe it was about 5,000 investigations of complaints. And those are a variety. Generally, we haven't tracked the slamming because we didn't have jurisdiction. We have it in our records if it was connected to something that we had jurisdiction over, like a billing issue.
Okay. Questions? Representative Rosenbaum.
Madam Chair, thank you. If this bill were to pass with these amendments and there were a pattern of a particular company having unauthorized changes to them as the long-distance carrier, what would the PUC do as a practical matter beyond just ordering them to change, or the local telephone company to change back to the carrier of choice? What would you do if there were a pattern of this happening?
As Commissioner Beyer mentioned, we have the authority to go to court. It's a very expensive process, and generally we don't do that because the expense of the process to go to circuit court is generally going to be about what you go after in a fine. Our current process is and how it would be under the slamming investigation is we have an internal investigation. There's a protocol that goes on as far as notifying the company that had the customer and the company that claims to have the customer. So there's a protocol that goes on there, and there's actually a fine that one of those companies pays to the other of 150% of the billing during that 30-day period that's outside of our process. So there's kind of a penalty, if you would, in there. But if we had a pattern, we would have the potential of going down in front of the commission and opening and requesting an open investigation, at which time it would be a docket, and we'd go through a process, and then we would decide if we're going to go to court after a fine. Generally, what we've done is reach some kind of agreement with the companies other than going to court.
Madam Chair, follow up.
I'm Rosenbaum.
Is this language about exclusive remedy contained in Oregon statute about any of the other authorities that the PUC currently has about regulating and protecting consumers in the telecommunications arena?
I believe Chairman Hemingway wants to comment on that.
Madam Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, I'm Roy Hemingway, the Chair of the Commission. I don't believe it is. This is a unique piece of language. The Commission has not had a chance to consider this particular amendment. We have legislative meetings twice a week, and this has come up since our last one last Thursday, and we've not had a chance to consider whether justice giving up this authority is compensated for by us having some authority to investigate individual complaints. I believe Mr. Romaine said that if that no other agency is losing authority here if we resolve a complaint. Well, the language as I read it says that even if we don't resolve a complaint, justice would lose its authority to deal with complaints of this nature. So that is a trade-off that the Commission will have to consider before saying that we support or oppose or have a neutral position with respect to these amendments.
And a follow-up, Madam Chair. Thank you. I, as an individual consumer, if I have a complaint that someone changed my long-distance company without my permission, go to you as the PUC. If you decide not to act on my complaint, under this language, do I lose the ability then to pursue this independently by getting a lawyer and going to court?
I believe the language is written with respect to other agencies of state government. I don't know that it removes your ability to take individual action, but I...
Well, maybe we could ask the Department of Justice to come up after these witnesses and answer that question.
And Madam Chair, if I may, I want to be clear. I don't want to be trying to practice law here in interpreting amendments. I think your counsel and justice is certainly more competent than I would be trying to give you a horseback opinion on this question.
Mr. Hemingway, I guess my concern is that we don't have a number of agencies doing the same thing. We don't have duplication of efforts. And because many states use the PUC and the Federal Communications Commission, that seemed the appropriate way to proceed. Do you see any fairness issues where companies have to deal with a number of agencies on this issue as opposed to dealing with one agency?
Madam Chair, I want to emphasize again the Commission has not had an opportunity to consider these amendments and to take a position. I do want to say, though, that with respect to other authorities, in other cases we have authority to deal with individual cases and to try to resolve those individual cases. But when there is a pattern of abuse by a company, justice acts independently of the Commission's action in individual cases. That's all I can say at this point.
Okay. Further questions? Thank you very much. Okay, we are in work session. I am going to have Cheryl Pellegrini come up from the Department of Justice to answer Representative Rosenbaum's question.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Cheryl Pellegrini, Oregon Department of Justice. I'm the attorney in charge of the Financial Fraud Consumer Protection Section. I would note for the record that the department has not previously seen these statute three amendments, nor were we consulted by the working group. To answer Representative Rosenbaum's question, Representative, you are correct. The way that the Dash 3 Amendment, Section 5, is written, it would deprive an individual consumer of seeking any other remedy that might be available to him or her at law were this amendment to be passed as it is currently drafted. It says that if the Public Utilities Commission assumes primary responsibility for resolving consumer complaints resulting prevents changes in a consumer's telecommunications carrier pursuant to this section, the processes and remedies adopted by the PUC are the exclusive remedy for those complaints, and no other civil action or state administrative proceeding may be commenced against a telecommunications carrier by reason of changes in a consumer's telecommunications carrier. So that does preclude not only that, that in essence prevents prevents the application of the Unlawful Trade Practices Act to slamming. And as you recall, that act provides both a private right of action as well as a right of action for the Department of Justice. I further note that I think that the position that the department took when it testified on these bills previously in January may have been misstated by Mr. Romaine. It is not that the Department of Justice has no authority to bring a lawsuit in the name of an individual consumer. However, that is not to say that we have no authority to act on behalf of individual consumers. In fact, we have five enforcement officers who handle over 17,000 consumer complaints every year. And what they do is that when we get a complaint, when we receive a complaint, in the process of developing that complaint to determine whether or not it's founded, and also to determine whether or not it it calls into question a pattern of practice as opposed to an individual dispute.
Cheryl, I remind you this is a work session, and your comments should be based on the amendment or the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My point is that the Department of Justice, in the process of investigating complaints, Madam Chair, we do resolve individual complaints. We have to work with them in order to determine whether or not there's a pattern of practice. What the Dash 3 amendments would do is it would prohibit the Department of Justice from doing that work. It means that we would no longer be able to bring a cause of action against a telecommunications company who was engaging in a pattern of practice because the PUC would have exclusive authority. So instead of, as it's been cast, vesting authority within the PUC to help consumers, it would also take away the ability of the Department of Justice to make sure that companies don't engage in this conduct in the future. The PUC has no authority under House Bill 2230 or the Dash amendments to provide any deterrent to companies from continuing to violate the law. The only thing that 2230 will do, and the only thing that the Dash 3 amendments will allow it to do, is to unwind a particular slam. That's all that will be accomplished through this bill.
Well, I want you to understand we can't have a number of agencies doing the same thing. And so we need to make a decision on where the appropriate authority should be, and that's why we have gone this direction. And I also want you to know that the Dash 3 was not available to any of us till 8:30 this morning. So it was available to everybody at the same time.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam, if I can follow up on this question.
We're going to go forward. We're in a work session, so we're not going to go into public hearing. Representative Merkley. Okay. Thank you, Cheryl.
Thank you, ma'am.
Well, we are going to wait on this bill. People have asked time to look at the amendment and to consider it, so we will take it up at a later time. I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2230. And he can talk about the Committee, we need to wait until 10:25 to, because we were late posting. We didn't get the LC draft that we're considering as a committee bill this morning, LC 3500. So we have to wait about 10 minutes. So we're going to recess until 10:25. Committee, we have a 1 LC draft to consider, and then we are finished
We want to drop this as a committee bill. We could not post until 10:25 Friday because we didn't have it. So that's why we've had this delay.
It's LC draft 3500.
Madam Chair, I would move that we introduce LC 3500 as a committee bill.
Okay. Representative Kitts moves that we adopt LC draft 3500 as a committee bill. Is there discussion? Representative Shockley.
I will vote to submit this as a committee bill and give it a public hearing if the chair so sees fit. But I do it with reluctance, and I have a lot of concerns about this and the language and what it would do as far as labor negotiations go. And I just wanted to express that. And in no way does this vote to submit it as a committee bill, as I've learned the hard way, in any way reflect my support of this language. Thank you.
Okay. We appreciate that comment. Representative Rosenbaum, did you have a comment?
Yes, I concur in those comments from Representative Shuffler. This is an extremely controversial proposal. I haven't had time to read it word for word, but just what I've gleaned from it, it limits the ability to strike on the part of agricultural employees and takes away an ability to mount secondary boycotts, both of which I know are firmly opposed by the Farm Workers Union. So I certainly have significant problems with it, but likewise, given the fact that there don't appear to be enough votes to introduce it just on the other side of the aisle, I will not stand in the way of that today, but I certainly have serious reservations about the bill as it moves forward.
Committee, this was a bill that we had in the special session. It did pass both houses. I think it's an important concept we need to discuss. We will have differing views on it. We will have people that don't agree. But I think that we would be remiss if we don't take this up because it is important to the agricultural community. But, you know, it will go through the normal debate process, and you will have an ability to vote yay or nay. Further discussion? Okay. I guess we'll call the roll on this one. Clerk, we'll call the roll.
Representative Gallegos?
Aye.
Representative Murphy?
Aye.
Representative Shoffler?
Aye.
Representative Kitts?
Aye.
Representative Rosenbaum? Chair Close.
Close aye. And motion carries. We adopt it. And is there anything else for the good of the committee? Okay. Oh, excuse me, Representative Merkley.
She said for the good of the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I request permission to vote on HB 2333.
Oh, I'm sorry. Slipped my mind. Representative Merkley has asked permission to vote on House Bill 2333. We need to suspend the rules. So, Representative Gallegos.
Madam Chair, I move we suspend the rules. Allow Representative Merkley to vote on House Bill 2333.
Representative Gallegos has moved that we suspend the rules, allow Representative Merkley to vote on House Bill 2333. Is there discussion or objection? Seeing none, so ordered. Representative Merkley, how do you vote?
Madam Chair, I vote aye.
Representative Merkley votes aye.
Thank you.
Okay. And if there's nothing else, go to the committee. We are adjourned.